Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
A loan for business, a little foreign aid, the difference money makes at home and abroad. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, January 3rd. Good to have you with us. And we are going to start with the bread and butter of many American businesses, loans. The volume of loans businesses take from banks can be an important economic indicator. That's money those companies might use to buy new equipment or stuff to sell, to expand their businesses or be more productive. And yet, despite a strong economy, last year the rate of business loan growth slowed. To be clear, it's not that corporate loans have shrunk, but rather where loans were growing in the double digits just a few years ago, loan growth was in the low single digits by the end of 2017. We sent Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson hunting for the reasons why.
Like any good mystery, there's not just one suspect here. In fact, there's lots of factors that may have contributed to this slowdown in corporate loan growth. Let's start with what these loans are actually for. Here's Gerard Cassidy at RBC Capital Markets.
Can be anything from a loan to Warren Buffett to finance an acquisition of a company that he wants to buy, to the hardware store owner in Burlington, Vermont, who's financing his inventory.
Cassidy says a big source of demand for these loans has typically come from the energy sector, which often needs to borrow to buy pricey equipment. But it's suffering from really low oil prices and is less able to borrow. Another driver of these loans are mergers and acquisitions. Slow time in M&A, less borrowing to finance them. Carl Tannenbaum, chief economist at Northern Trust, has a few more suspects.
Companies are very, very profitable. They are generating an immense amount of cash flow, which can obviate the need to go to their banks to borrow money.
Or maybe they're skipping banks and borrowing from investors instead through bonds. That's been pretty cheap and easy lately. There's also a tax piece to this puzzle, says John Graham, a finance professor at Duke.
Companies heard all about tax reform coming. And some of the tax reforms they knew were going to restrict their ability to deduct interest, and so they might have been holding off on borrowing.
That could restrict future borrowing, too. But Graham says with the strengthening economy, businesses might start spending more in 2018 and need to borrow more, too. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
A lot of what we hear about President Trump's foreign policy comes from his Twitter feed. Over the past few days, he's tweeted quite a bit about foreign aid. On New Year's Day, he complained about the amount we send to Pakistan and criticized its government for not doing more to stop terrorism. Yesterday, he targeted aid to Palestinians, questioning whether payments should continue. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more on the role of aid in American foreign policy.
About 1% of the federal budget goes to foreign aid. That's still about $40 to $50 billion. Some of the money is military aid, some goes to economic development, health, or humanitarian aid.
Sometimes foreign aid is thought of as just an exercise in charity.
Richard Fontaine is with the Center for a New American Security.
But it's not only an exercise in goodwill, it's also an exercise in seeking short and long-term interests.
But foreign aid is a long-term strategy, says Cindy Huang at the Center for Global Development.
It's about building longer-term relationships and partnerships and not a tit-for-tat where everything that the country does needs to respond to an immediate U.S. interest.
And the president isn't the only one with a say in who gets aid and when.
It's not so easy to say, you know, we should stop funding a certain account because Congress does have a very strong role in creating the budget.
Especially since a lot of the aid going to foreign countries is used to buy American goods and services, says Stuart Patrick at the Council on Foreign Relations.
meaning that much of the aid that's often thought of as going to other countries is actually much of that assistance actually remains in the United States for practical purposes.
And he says cutting aid when countries don't do what we want often results in America having less leverage, not more. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a new round of record-breaking highs. Details when we do the numbers. If you took a break from the news over the holidays, you might have missed a number of federal regulatory rollbacks in the last weeks of 2017. They affect everything from oil and gas to migratory birds. Washington Post national political correspondent James Homan analyzed the list of regulations that the Trump administration changed, and he joins me now. Thanks for coming on.
Good to be with you, Lizzie.
You wrote in your story that these regulatory changes reveal the president's true priorities. What do you mean by that?
Donald Trump campaigned like a populist, but for the last year, he's governed like a plutocrat. He made a bunch of policy decisions intended to get as little public attention as possible over the holidays that show that he's pursuing policies that benefit the 1%.
Well, I want to unpack some of the regulatory rollbacks that you talked about. One of them affects offshore drilling.
Yeah.
And really was designed to put in place some different safety checks after the Deepwater Horizon spill. Can you walk me through what the president did?
Absolutely. So after Barack Obama ordered a presidential commission, a bipartisan commission to come together, there was a lot of deliberations. They consulted industry and they came up with new regulations designed to prevent another BP oil spill. And those cost money, and oil companies don't want to pay that money. So Trump gets into office, and they went through all the regulations, and they changed a lot of companies should do this to companies could do this. And so there's a ton of changes that really take all the teeth out of these regulations and, frankly, could increase the risk of another major oil spill.
You know, another issue is staffing at federal agencies. You mentioned specifically the Occupational Safety and Health Administration dropping 119 permanent workers. You know, you could make the argument that this is a bloated federal bureaucracy, and doing this is indeed following through on some of the president's campaign promises. How do you read the scaling back of regulatory agencies?
They're pretty open about what they're trying to do. They're trying to starve the beast. Trump is trying to demoralize career federal civil servants to get them to quit. And the reason it matters at OSHA is that in order for fines and enforcement actions to be levied against companies that don't have good workplace safety, multiple managers have to sign off on the enforcement action. And because a bunch of managers have left from various field offices, those enforcement actions aren't getting signed off on. And after a certain period of months goes by, then the enforcement action is null and void. And so a lot of companies are hoping that Trump doesn't staff up again at OSHA, and so they will get off the hook when they break workplace safety rules.
Let's do one more here, and that is no federal funding directed toward a new Amtrak tunnel that would connect New Jersey to Penn Station. This seems to fly in the face of the president's promises about infrastructure. At the same time, we're talking about a big project in a very blue area.
Yeah, in this case, this is arguably the most important infrastructure project currently underway in the country, connecting Penn Station to New Jersey. The tunnel that exists now has a lot of problems and is way overburdened. And Barack Obama made a deal with Chris Christie, the Republican governor of New Jersey, and Andrew Cuomo, the Democratic governor of New York, that the federal government would pick up half the tab for this. And on the Friday night before New Year's Eve, when no one was paying attention, the Federal Transit Administration, someone appointed by Trump, said, "We consider that deal null and void, and we're not going to do it." And some of this, I think, is ideological. And it's also part of a pattern that Trump really does act like he's the president of the red states of America, not the United States. We've seen that with a lot of other policies, including the health care bill earlier last year. And he's helping places where he thinks they support him.
James Homan is a national political correspondent for The Washington Post. You can read his full story there. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We reached out to the White House for comment about the president's infrastructure policy, and we've not heard back by deadline. As for the oil drilling policy, the administration said their changes will save companies at least $288 million over 10 years. When a refugee arrives in this country, a number of different agencies exist to help him or her get set up. In December, the Trump administration ordered that groups the government hires to do this that get fewer than 100 refugees at a site will have to close. Over the next few months, that could mean dozens of offices. It's just the latest challenge for nonprofits that handle everything from picking up refugees at the airport to finding them apartments and English classes. In Pennsylvania, Emma Jacobs reports.
A small class of refugees recently arrived in Philadelphia are learning how to fill out American-style job applications. They're from around the world, Ethiopia, Guatemala, Bhutan. This class is much smaller than in past years at the Nationality Service Center, which does resettlement work for the government. Executive Director Margaret O'Sullivan says that between October and the end of December,
we'll have resettled 45 refugees. Last year, at the same period of time, it was 146.
Those numbers began to fall almost as soon as President Trump took office. Various versions of the administration's travel ban have tried to stop the flow of refugees from places like Syria and Somalia. And the administration lowered total refugee admissions to levels not seen since the 1980s. The government pays nonprofits about $2,000 per refugee, so this has forced many to restructure.
We had layoffs in the spring. We had both layoffs and position freezes that we never rehired.
Until he was laid off in August, Todd Miller helped resettle refugees at the organization Bethany Christian Services in Pennsylvania.
It's really one of the most meaningful jobs I've ever done in my life.
But he and many of his colleagues are moving to other fields. Miller now teaches English as a second language part-time at a local university.
I have a family that's counting on me for income. You need to make sure that you're in something that's not going to disappear soon after you start.
The Obama administration set a goal for fiscal year 2017 of admitting 110,000 refugees. The Trump administration reduced that to 50,000 and lowered that to 45,000 in this fiscal year. The State Department says this reduction is needed to make time for more vetting and to process a backlog of asylum applications from people already inside the U.S. But now, with the closing of smaller sites, those who work with refugees warn they're losing institutional knowledge and infrastructure.
Administrations come and they go.
That's Danielle Grigsby, Associate Director of the Coalition Refugee Council USA.
And policies around refugees and numbers change and shift. And so what we are also facing with these closures is the cost that it would take to regrow the program.
Smaller offices also continue to help refugees already resettled in their area. Grigsby says the disruptions throughout the system will make it difficult for the administration to reach even its new lower target for refugee arrivals.
These executive orders and then the administrative changes further hinder the ability for the U.S. government to arrive 45,000. And this all in light of the world's worst, most intense refugee crisis.
She says the government isn't on pace to meet that number so far. At the end of the first quarter of the fiscal year, the State Department says that's a premature assessment. In Philadelphia, I'm Emma Jacobs for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I'm really hoping that I will make that list, that lottery list.
Waiting for a spot on the waiting list. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 104 points, 0.4% to close at 24,824. The NASDAQ climbed 101 points, 1.4% to finish at 7,004. And the S&P 500 rose 21 points, 0.8% to end at 2694. Chips, they make the world go round. computer chips, that is, and what's being called a fundamental security flaw for chip giant Intel means a boost for its rival AMD. That helped send AMD shares up 9.8%. Intel lost nearly 6%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.44%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. The Housing Choice Voucher Program is the country's largest housing subsidy. You probably know it better as Section 8. And it gives rental assistance to more than 2 million low-income families. But that's just 25% of people who are eligible. Demand for vouchers far outweighs supply, and long waiting lists have become the norm. Meanwhile, proposed budget cuts at the Department of Housing and Urban Development may make things worse. In Los Angeles, vouchers are so limited that the city's waiting list had been closed for more than a decade. Late last year, it finally began taking applications for a lottery just to get on the list. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
If you live in L.A. and wanted Section 8, October was your rare shot. The first application period for a Section 8 voucher lottery in 13 years. Valerie Stacker submitted hers as soon as she could. She's a 62-year-old retiree and primary caregiver to her 10-year-old grandson.
I'm really hoping that I will make that list, that lottery list.
In November, Stacker showed me around her apartment in South L.A. Two bedrooms, but she splits the $1,500 rent with a friend who uses one. She and her grandson Angel stay in the other, in a bunk bed.
I sleep at the bottom, and Angel sleeps at the top. So we have the TV in here, and he has some games and stuff like that.
Stacker worked for General Motors in Illinois before retiring. She's been using her roughly $20,000 a year in retirement benefits to raise Angel since he was an infant.
Feeding him and clothing him is just almost impossible because of having to give all my money toward rent.
She figured the Section 8 lottery could be the answer.
I'm motivated for Angel so he'll have his own space where he can play and, you know, have fun.
Stacker was one of 188,000 people who applied for 20,000 spots in the voucher waiting line. And that line won't be moving quickly. Carlos Van Adder runs the Section 8 program for the Housing Authority of the City of Los Angeles. He says only a couple thousand vouchers become available here every year, basically when a pay raise makes someone ineligible or someone dies.
And even at that list of 20,000, way less than the number of people who applied, it will take us up to 10 years to get through that list.
Even with a voucher, there's no guarantee you'll find a landlord who will take it. Recipients have just 6 months to sign a lease or lose their voucher altogether. In L.A., only 60% are successful. Keely Stater at the Public Affordable Housing Research Corporation says that doesn't seem to put people off. Los Angeles has one of the longest waits in the country.
Los Angeles City Housing Authority is number two in terms of the waiting list and the number of people that might be waiting if the waiting list had not been closed for so long, just behind New York City.
The national average wait for vouchers is more than 2 years, and about half of all housing authorities have closed their lists. Meanwhile, President Trump's proposed 2018 budget would slash more than $6 billion from the U.S. Housing Office, or HUD, which funds Section 8.
Really deep cuts.
Doug Rice works for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
On our estimate, the administration's request for housing vouchers, for example, would have left roughly 250,000 housing vouchers without funding next year.
Thank you for calling the Housing Authority of the City of Los Angeles Section 8 waiting list information line.
A few weeks ago, Valerie Stacker called in to finally learn if she'd won a place on the list.
To find out if you were selected to be placed on the Section 8 waiting list, please gather your confirmation number and press 1.
Stacker entered her information and spoke with an operator at the Housing Authority.
They said that I did not receive it. Like they said, it was random. And if you got picked, you got picked. If you didn't, you didn't.
She's disappointed she didn't get picked, but Stacker understood the odds and the need in Los Angeles. She says she'll stay put in her cramped apartment for now.
I'm sure there will be other possibilities. I will have my own space. I'm going to make that happen, yeah.
If she can't find assistance elsewhere, Stacker can always reapply for Section 8 when L.A. opens its waiting list again in another decade or so. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
New York, we are preparing for the bomb cyclone. Oh, how I wish I was making that term up. But this major winter storm has already brought snow to Florida and Georgia and is threatening the East Coast with negative temperatures and nasty wind chill. Along with this could come a new record, the most natural gas used in a single day in the U.S. Yes, even more gas to heat our homes than the also awesomely named polar vortex of 2014. So how well are utilities set up to handle all this? Marketplace's Jed Kim has our story.
The U.S. shale oil juggernaut has been pumping, and early winter was warmish, so we aren't in danger of running out of natural gas. Mark Sadegan watches energy markets for Fitch Ratings. He says supplies are
very robust, and they have been for a while, and there's just sort of a wall of gas at relatively low prices that's available, assuming you have the infrastructure to get it out.
And there's not enough infrastructure to meet this peak demand in New England, which is far from shale gas supplies. John Larson is with the consultancy firm Rhodium Group.
There's only so much gas that can get through the pipes up to that region. And as a consequence, when you have a cold snap like this, you can see gas prices spike considerably, like a factor of 10.
Those spikes get passed on to ratepayers, though consumers' bills often even out when utilities' backup plans kick in. And utilities up north do plan for winter, storing gas underground, making advanced deals to get more, or import if necessary. But this crazy widespread cold snap?
When an event like this happens, it can go outside of their planning horizon.
Chris McGill is with the American Gas Association. He saw natural gas prices spike to 30 times their usual rate on the day after Christmas. That only lasted for a few hours as supplies were secured and prices settled. But continuing cold means we'll see more of that scrambling. Rhodium Group's John Larson lives in Massachusetts.
The worst is yet to come. Where I live, it's going to be a high of 1 degree on Saturday.
He expects ping-ponging natural gas prices, like the cold, to keep on for weeks. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Every action has an equal opposite reaction. And on Broadway, when you have Hamilton, yeah, that's what I was doing there, you get a record-breaking year at the box office, $1.6 billion overall. That's how much Broadway shows made in 2017, breaking the previous record of $1.12 billion in 2014. Gordon Cox is the theater editor at Variety, and he joins me. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
$1.6 billion is a lot of money. Is this all Hamilton or what?
It's not all Hamilton, but Hamilton and shows like it are kind of the chief reason behind it. Last year in particular, there were a number of shows, a larger number of shows than usual, that were sort of ultra hot tickets like Hamilton. It's that fact combined with the fact that producers are understanding more and more that there are shows that can bear extremely high premium prices. You know, Hamilton went up to $1,150 a ticket for, you know,
I mean, that's
the premium
insane
prices. And it's a huge number, and they only did it for this very high demand week between Christmas and New Year's, but it is big enough to grab headlines and might make people think that all of Broadway is starting to cost, you know, $1,000 a ticket, which it's not.
How much does this sort of crazy pricing situation change the content of what is produced on Broadway? I mean, I'm thinking in part of two plays by Pulitzer-winning playwrights Paula Vogel, Lynn Nottage, that, you know, opened and then didn't have huge runaway financial successes, and yet things that are, you know, Disney fare and musicals did. I mean, does it change what producers are willing to finance?
To a degree, yes. And that has been happening over a long period of years. As Broadway becomes more and more kind of tourist dependent, it's musicals that bring in the tourists, particularly the international tourists. And what that means is musicals are a more appealing genre to produce than something like a play, when even, as you mentioned, those plays that had the highest possible pedigree and were all three stellar productions closed very quickly.
Well, what does that mean when you look ahead to sort of the balance of 2018, but also how Broadway shakes out, you know, in the future?
Some of the producers I talk about and theater people in the industry are actually very concerned about specifically things like you mentioned, the Broadway play, as more and more musicals make more and more money. And carve out long lives in what is a limited supply of Broadway theaters, that we're kind of squeezing the Broadway play out of the picture. There is enough kind of financial incentive to, you know, embrace the musical and maybe forget about everything but the kind of the biggest huge smash hit plays, like, for instance, the Amy Schumer play that Steve Martin right. wrote called Meteor Shower, that there might need to be sort of an industry-wide initiative to really think about kind of sustaining the play in the current marketplace.
Have they figured out the economics of that?
Nope. I mean, when it works great. But, you know, for a smaller scale, well-reviewed, well-respected show with a kind of modest audience, it's very, very hard to make that model work these days. So that's what they're trying to figure out.
Gordon Cox, theater editor at Variety, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This final note before we go today, someone in Denmark appears to have stolen the world's most expensive bottle of vodka, worth $1.3 million. According to Danish TV, the bottle of Russo-Baltique is made of gold and silver with a diamond-encrusted cap. It was swiped from a bar in Copenhagen where it had been on loan from a Russian businessman. No idea if it tastes any better than regular vodka. Today, the Dow jumped 104 points, 0.4%. The Nasdaq climbed 101 points, 1.4%. And the S&P 500 rose 21 points, 0.8%. Sarah Bruguer, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday engineer the program for us. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. See you all tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.